Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 312, we return for a discussion about scope of practice in ophthalmology and the use of physician extenders in ophthalmology, and especially in retina. Doctors Paul Sternberg and Sriji Patel from Vanderbilt University join me for this group discussion, and we discuss many topics, including how intravitreal injections are currently being employed by many practices and what that may mean for the future. Remember that you can claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. They'll also contain a list of financial disclosures for all participants. And remember that we can also find this episode and all our other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with two prominent retina specialists from Vanderbilt University. First, I'll go in alphabetical order, Dr. Sriji Patel, who's a friend of the program, been on often. Sriji, hello.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And we're honored to be joined by Dr. Paul Sternberg, who has many hats at Vanderbilt University, but he's been on the podcast before to discuss legal issues. And Dr. Sternberg, now we're going to unfortunately read off some things that you and Sriji have written back to you, but hopefully in a much more comfortable environment than any sort of legal proceeding. Thanks again for taking the time.
You're welcome. Well, depending on what you read back, I'll tell you whether I'm enjoying this or not.
well, it's all going to be, so we got a lot being relative for a retina specific podcast, but we got a lot of emails about this subject. So the two of you wrote a great article in Retina Times recently. And actually this article covered many things. Remember Retina Times, the official publication of ASRS. And
right.
It covered kind of a whole bunch of things that will be facing retina specialists in the future. But the part that at least that I saw that got a lot of interest and people asked about was there was a quote about scope of practice. And so I'm going to read that quote back. So you guys wrote, "A growing cause for concern among all ophthalmologists, retina specialists included, is scope of practice creep. Retinal evaluations procedures performed by non-retina trained medical staff represent an important threat to the interests of the profession and patients. As technology improves, office interventions are becoming more time and cost efficient." And I'll skip ahead. "We now perform minimally invasive vision-saving office-based procedures with little or no anesthesia. However, this creates opportunities for non-retina specialists to encroach on our scope of practice with unclear implications for patients." So Dr. Sternberg, I'll let you go first. So first of all, for the listeners who are reading that or hearing that, or let's say hearing that for the first time, what specifically are you referring to as a threat there? And what sort of real world things are we already seeing that represent maybe the tip of that iceberg that's coming?
So I think that the threat I kind of view through two lenses. Historically, I've seen many retinal procedures that were exclusively done by retina specialists evolve to becoming more mainstream. When I was a trainee, no one did lasers, retinal lasers, other than retina specialists. Then PRP gradually moved to become something that residents would do, and general ophthalmologists would do, and then focal laser and some treatment of retinal tears. All of that was the exclusive province of the retina specialist when I did my residency and fellowship. So the fact that there are things that start out as unique to a specialist, be it retina or otherwise, and over time transition to become more mainstream, I think is just the nature of our business, of any business. And as long as the decision-making by the person who does it is appropriate, referrals are appropriate, I think we have to anticipate that. What worries me more is when we abrogate that care to non-MDs. And I'm increasingly hearing about practices that employ PAs or nurse practitioners to assist with procedures, particularly intravitreal injections. And that's where I think it becomes a very slippery slope. Because they're technically supervised by ophthalmologists, these are things that they may be able to kind of skirt the regulations to be able to do. there's fairly strict guidelines for optometrists that prohibit them from doing these procedures. But if we're going to empower non-doctors, not just not optometrists to do this, then the case to have optometrists doing them becomes very challenging for us to defend. I can't imagine, being in front of a legislative panel where optometrists are asking for the authorization to give intravitreal injections and them having PAs saying that they're already doing it. What's right. our defense?
Yeah.
And
what do you think, Srijee? What would be your defense?
Well, I'll add to that. That's going to be a tough defense because to the point that Dr. Sternberg makes, because there are no regulations, there's actually a good amount of data that has been amassed regarding the delivery of intravitreal injections by non-retina specialists and non-physicians. And so that data can be used, to defend physician extenders or even optometrists giving these injections. And, I would argue that without the proper training to be not only to deliver the medicine, but to be able to look for the potential complications and treat the complications, something I always say is you shouldn't be doing a procedure unless you can deal with any potential complication that can arise from that procedure, right? But if we don't have the data to support that, retina specialists are the ones that are equipped to be doing these procedures, very quickly that scope of practice creep can start occurring.
So let's take the financial component out of it. We can always come back to that because there are people listening who are also going to say, maybe off the record, practically speaking, and we'll just address the elephant in the room. Some retina specialists don't want extenders or other people to do it, maybe because they're worried about their patients, but also bottom line, these procedures do generate revenue for a practice or a provider. But let's take that out of this and just talk about the most important salient issue, which is, as Dr. Sternberg and you, Srijee, have said, which is patient outcomes and patient care, right? What is best for the patients? And so Srijee, you brought up the point, which I was thinking, if you argue that side, I would say, look, if you can't manage the complications of the procedure, right? If you're a nurse extender, a PA, or a physician extender, like a PA or an NP, or even an optometrist, if you cannot manage endophthalmitis, for example, it happens from the intravitreal injection, then you should not do the procedure. But the devil's advocate argument, Dr. Sternberg, would be you see that even in our own field, there are procedures that people do. People do phacal emulsification of cataracts and have complications that they cannot manage on their own. They need to call a subspecialist to help them. What is kind of the precedent for that being a reason not to allow someone to do a procedure? Because I feel like in a lot of fields of medicine, now ophthalmology, people do unfortunately do procedures that they necessarily cannot manage all the complications. And maybe it's not feasible to limit procedures to people only who have the capacity to manage complications, which you could argue in a court of law or even in just in passing, that's a rare event complication to get endophthalmitis.
Yeah, I guess your point is correct. We all see things that could be potential complications of our activity where we will refer them to someone else to manage that complication. Post-cataract endophthalmitis or post-filter endophthalmitis is a classic example of circumstances where the primary caregiver refers them to another specialist to take care of it. I'm a little bit more worried about the rare, but will they recognize which patients have elevated IOP after the injection? Which patients are at higher risk of have fragile nerves and may need to monitor the IOP afterwards and perhaps do paracentesis to make sure that the patient doesn't develop an artery occlusion at the time of the injection. What will they be able to recognize patients when they perforate the lens? Will they be able to recognize patients where they give a a choroidal injection versus an intravitreal injection, vitreous hemorrhages, suprachoroidal hemorrhages? I mean, there are complications that do occur infrequently, largely, but pressure issues are something that we think about pretty routinely in our clinics, that I'm not sure that a non-MD, non-retina specialist even is really prepared to be aware of. They're really just a technician. And yes, can you teach people to do an injection? Of course you can. that's not the point. Technically, it's fairly straightforward, and it's delicate. We're talking about narrow gauge needles and eyeballs, but you and I, you know, we teach them to do it. I mean, we have people working in our labs that are doing injections in animal eyes where the eyes are even smaller. So, but managing the potential risks and making sure that when you've done something wrong, you recognize it so you can take care of it. That's where I worry.
Oh, I'll add that our anterior segment colleagues, while they may not be able to manage endophthalmitis, they can detect it at the earliest signs, and they've received the training to figure out that something's not right. This person needs to see a retina specialist today or in the next few hours. And so they've had the experience and training to recognize the issues and pick them up so that even if there are potential risks to the patient, they can get them back on the right track. And I think that those years of training really pay off in those rare instances where something could be going on, but being able to recognize the issue.
And so let's follow up on that point, because I think there's a whole spectrum of people in the retina community, as there is in any community, who believe certain things. And I think there are people in the retina community who are already using physician extenders and would respond to this, or if they're brought on, would extol the benefits. And we'll get into some of those benefits maybe in terms of delivery of care on a national level with a growing base of patients who need treatment. And there's people across the spectrum all the way on the other side who feel that even ophthalmologists who are not retina specialists should not be managing certain things, but end up managing those things because they just choose to manage it because of referral patterns. That is what ends up happening. And Dr. Sternberg, that goes back to the interesting kind of give and take, like you were talking about. There aren't actual strict definitions for many of these things about who can do what, right? Optometry is, there's some outlined rules in each state because of these scope battles over time between ophthalmologists and optometrists. But within ophthalmology, retina is not a board certified subspecialty, right? You know, that there's a certain competency maybe you need to have for surgical credentialing, but the question of who does what seems to vary so much regionally and geographically, and depends. If you talk to fellows or residents who've gone out, you know, it's completely different. Some places anterior segment manages this, sometimes the optometrists manage this, sometimes the retina specialists get to refer this and not that. And so the real question is, do you think that should be structured, right? So like, should there be some give and take because different regions have different needs and kind of different availabilities of those different providers? Or do you set those definitions because maybe it's a little safer for patients? Because they say, what's the number one thing? You don't know what you don't know. And if you are managing something that necessarily you were trained to manage, you know, you may never refer it out, which the danger is not that you see something and you refer it to somebody. The danger is you see something and you choose to keep it and manage it and you don't manage it correctly.
Well, the oversight of ambulatory practice is quite limited, as everyone knows. You don't need any formal delineation of privileges for what you do in your own office. And yes, there's board certification, but even board certification isn't required for you to provide eye care. It is sometimes controlled by the insurance carrier as to whether they're willing to credential you to provide that care. And some insurance companies will have certain procedures where they'll credential you and certain ones that they won't. But most of your credential as an ophthalmologist, and they may or may not require a board certification. So the oversight is extremely limited. And I'm not exactly one that wants to beat up the practitioner requiring additional bureaucratic documentation and oversight. And we certainly hope that we train, I think those of us who are in settings where we are training retinal specialists, ophthalmologists, will provide the appropriate ethical guidelines and guardrails that will, you know, make sure that they do the right thing, that they provide the care that they're trained to do. You're absolutely right, Jay. There are parts of this country where there's huge numbers of diabetics, let's say, who are in need of care, and where there's not a retina specialist that's convenient to them, and they don't have the wherewithal to get to a retina specialist. So how is their diabetic macular edema or their proliferative diabetic retinopathy going to get managed? And if there were a way that someone who is not a retina specialist can provide intravitreal injections or lasers to these, there's going to be tremendous reduction in blindness and allowing people to continue to work and take care of their families. Those are difficult problems for us to balance. So there's not one size fits all.
Yeah. And Sriji, let's go, because I'm going to take the other side of the argument here. The other side of the argument, which I teased, is, and Dr. Sternberg just outlined, is you can just say, look, you retina guys, you want to do all these procedures, you want to keep this volume and protect this for yourselves, but it's just simply not feasible. It's not feasible for you to do this many injections. You have an exponentially growing population. We have a population of diabetics and macular degeneration patients that need treatment, that wait weeks and months sometimes to see a retina specialist, depending on the area they're in. And you are not going to deliver good care because you simply just can't see all of them. And so physician extenders allow you to extend your influence. You're allowed, just like it did in anesthesia, you can take care of many more patients. We don't need more retina specialists. We just need the retina specialists to work smarter and be more managerial, because as Dr. Sternberg just outlined, again, this is devil's advocate. This is not a complex procedure to do technically. So as long as you have someone overseeing it who can manage those complications if they happen, how is this different than CRNAs with anesthesia? How do you kind of mentally process that and respond to that in terms of viewing the future of healthcare and retina care delivery?
Sure. I mean, I think that yours is a good question that probably doesn't have one great solution. One thing that I never underestimate is the ingenuity and the wherewithal of our profession to be able to solve tough problems. If you think about it, not that long ago, we were, you know, doing monthly injections, and now we have medications with more durability, and we figured out that certain regimens allow us to see patients, you know, every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks, maybe even farther out, for example. And so I think that as the technology improves and the medicines improve, we will be able to, quote, you know, extend ourselves first. But also, you know, there's a big push towards getting telemedicine in these areas that may be harder for retina specialists to reach, for example. And that's a great opportunity for us to monitor patients that we think may need to travel further. Obviously, retina specialists have been going to satellites for decades to try and get closer to the areas that of need. I think that just giving up our the skills that we've trained so hard to perfect and work on, without, you know, really paying attention to who's going to be doing, you know, administering these procedures, is a very superficial answer to a complex problem. I don't think that actually really tests our ability to solve this issue if we just say, oh, well, we'll just let anyone do it, just so that we can get the patients out of our office.
But I will say that, if you know, on the spectrum of who's going to do it, I would rather have a comprehensive ophthalmologist be doing injections than a PA doing injections. And just like, you know, for a while we were getting inundated with PRPs, and we were very comfortable over time having that evolve into going beyond retina specialists. And there are communities where still retina specialists do all the lasers, right? You know, but there are communities where they do very few. And I think that's okay. And so the concept that this may, over time, assuming we don't develop alternatives to frequent injections, and I hope we do, the concept that this will evolve to being something that may be done in some communities by general ophthalmologists, I'm much less afraid of that than I am of it moving out of the scope of an ophthalmologist. It truly is still a delicate ophthalmic procedure, and it needs to be done by someone who has had a minimum of 3 years learning how to do that.
Well, and then there's a slippery slope. So to your question, from a patient standpoint, you would much rather have somebody you know who's done the training than someone else. But transparency is often brought up in scope arguments that there's a lack of transparency. And patients, unfortunately, don't know who's delivering their care sometimes. Advertising can be opaque, and patients don't have a good understanding of who's which health provider and what their training and educational background is. And even if they did, unfortunately, with insurance and other things, sometimes it gets complicated that they end up in a scenario. I'm not talking about ophthalmology anymore. I'm talking about other fields of medicine where often they aren't interfacing with an MD a lot of the time. So my question about the slippery slope, Dr. Sternberg, is, and anesthesia is pointed to as the classic example, right? The anesthesiology community started training CRNAs and started having these CRNAs. And then there were stories during the COVID pandemic, and this now we're going more to the finances of what it means for the retina field, where a lot of anesthesiologists, for example, were laid off or replaced with CRNAs, or there's financial reasons why people may prefer to hire a CRNA over an anesthesiologist. And as more and more of the structures that own healthcare are not necessarily as invested in the outcomes of the patient, but more in the bottom line, the concern would be for patient care is, could that also happen to retina, right? Could you reach a point where, and it'd take a long time for this to happen, where the stability of practicing as a retina specialist on the standpoint of the financial side for retina specialists, but also on the other side, if you're a patient, not necessarily having access to retina specialists because, you know, private equity, venture capital, other sort of organizations that enter healthcare choose to hire a cheaper alternative that can they believe can offer the same output when they look at output as simply the number of procedures, the number of injections, et cetera, rather than any sort of patient care outcome factor.
You know, Jay, it's almost a rhetorical question.
A leading course, question. I'm good at leading questions.
I said rhetorical question. Because I think the answer is, of course, there are economic forces that will impact how practice is provided and will impact the future of our profession. I'll be honest with you. My fear, this is an old man talking about retina, is that practices like mine and yours have grown dramatically in terms of the number of doctors we have in order to manage the overwhelming need for injections. I mean, that's been the major driver for us adding more doctors, not been how many surgeries we're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's almost not been how many patients we're seeing. So when we develop a treatment that doesn't require as frequent intervention, we develop a longer lasting treatment, something where you only have to see the patient once or twice a year. Suddenly, our schedules are going to open up widely. And are we going to have a glut of retina specialists? And if that's the case, there won't be the need for us to have PAs doing our injections, because there won't be that many injections that we're going to be doing. Quite honestly, I'm a little, fortunately, every time there has been a great advance where we've learned how to take care of something better, we've added something else to our portfolio. So, you know, when lasers moved comprehensive ophthalmologists, we suddenly had macular hole surgery. Mm-hmm. And then we had injections. We may have gene therapy, subretinal injections may be something that we have to add as intravitreal injections disappear. But I do wonder, in the post-injection era, which there will be, what is the future of the retina specialist? Mm-hmm. You know, will there be enough work for us?
Well, and to your point, will there be a post-injection era if we start treating dry AMD with injections? The jury's still out on what will happen there.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Well, I think, or will the successful dry AMD treatment be something that is longer lasting and mm-hmm. may not require as frequent injections? Obviously, if we, and that goes back to my, when one door closes, another door opens.
Right.
And that's dry, you know, I think there's no one who's listening who wouldn't love for us to have a door open to treatment for dry AMD. But if that happens, the burden of caring for them becomes the concept is overwhelming to me.
Yeah, it's hard to even think about it. Yeah. Srijee, I mean, and I think we'll all say, kind of closing, I mean, we still are obviously in an awesome specialty, the best specialty, and arguably, hopefully everyone who's listening agrees, maybe not the ophthalmologist listening, the best subspecialty, at least we're all happy and to do what we're doing. How do you feel as a younger specialist? And then when you interface with a lot of fellows and people, I mean, how do you feel morale is about the specialty of retina? Because these are all things that people with experience and wisdom can look back and reflect and kind of see the history of how things change. Dr. Sternberg just kind of outlined how things changed over the last couple of decades in terms of what retina specialists did. I'm curious how younger folks react to these sort of concepts. Do you think this is on the radar for most people? Do you think about this? I mean, and do you, what sort of things do you think about as a younger person when you look at 10, 15, 20, 25 years?
Yeah, I think if you take one step back, the way I look at this problem is really retina specialists are almost victims of their own success. I mean, we have great treatments from brilliant people that really help our patients see better and better when not that long ago there wasn't options. I mean, each of us will encounter patients in every clinic that tell us that their parents went blind from the same thing that has kept them driving and functioning and taking care of themselves. And so to some extent, I think morale is great because the real, this issue about scope of, you know, kind of scope creep really only arises from the fact that we're so busy because our skills are so sought after because we're just, you know, I don't want to toot our own horn, but we're very good at what we do. There are clearly deficiencies, but, and we have treatments and not cures, and that's part of the problem. But I think that morale is great because, you know, I agree with Dr. Sternberg that there will be a post-injection future, but in that period, I think that we'll be doing a lot more gene therapy or stem cells or RPE transplants. I think something will fill that gap because there are always going to be patients that are losing their vision from critical conditions that really we're going to have the expertise to treat. And at the same time, right now, we're kind of leading into giving a lot of injections and maybe doing it for NPDR and AMD, and that is creating a problem. But these problems are... the solutions that are being presented are not great long-term solutions, in my opinion. And so I think that those types of solutions are typically weeded out over time. And I think retina specialists will continue to be in high demand, maybe for different things than what we are for today. But I think overall, the morale is great. I mean, I my practice, as I'm sure yours, just keeps getting busier and busier. Yeah. Yeah. And to some extent, that's a great thing. I don't ever worry about where, if I'm going to get patients coming through the door. That is 0% concern in my head.
Yeah. And I just remember we'll wrap up here and we're not going to dive into a humongous topic. We spent another half hour talking about it, but you guys referenced when you wrote this later, you know, you also have to think about all this in the context of cost, right? And the US system and the healthcare system. And I feel like it's almost like global warming or climate change or any of these long-term issues, right? I feel like I've been hearing about costs of the healthcare system dating to high school. It's been 2 decades and I've heard about it. And I heard about it in undergrad, and I heard about it in med school, and I heard about it as a resident, and I heard about it as a fellow, and I'm hearing about it as faculty. And we see the numbers, and it's like, it's almost like the unfortunate Stalin quote where the statistic just becomes a statistic, and you just see numbers, and it's really hard to visualize the cost. But at some point, you know, everyone's talked about sustainability for decades. It doesn't seem sustainable yet. We still keep doing it, and the costs keep going up. So like the one part I think that we have talked about is costs. Is if it's decided by a payer that it's more cost effective to deliver care via non-retina specialists, and we've already set that precedent, then that becomes a tougher argument, like you said, to say this is not the way we should be cutting costs, is by having patients get procedures from someone who have not been sufficiently trained to recognize issues.
Well, remember that the reimbursement is not based on who's doing it, mm-hmm. based on what's being done. So the carrier doesn't save any money by having a physician extender do the injection versus a retina specialist. The person that saves the money is you. Okay. Yeah. So let this not take that cost to society. This has nothing to do with cost to society or cost to the insurance company. The people that are passing this on are doing it either because they're overwhelmed and they can't handle the business. I'll give them that take the high road, or they're doing it because they want to make more money. That's probably the lower road. But passing this on, extending scope of practice, does not save anybody money in terms of society. If you're looking at the big picture, looking at global warming, it ain't going to help.
Yeah. I love this conversation. I really appreciate you guys writing that. And obviously the best, when you know you've written something good, is when you get a lot of feedback, and maybe you guys have gotten other feedback on this article and what you wrote, but it's funny how one paragraph can really influence and impact people. That makes you want to keep writing. So Dr. Paul Sternberg, Dr. Sriji Patel, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this issue. And listeners, if you have more thoughts on this issue, I'm sure we could talk about this more. Just let us know. We can always come back and discuss more of this, but thank you both for your time today.
Jay, enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah. Thank you, Jay.
Take care.
Many thanks to Drs. Sternberg and Patel for joining me for this episode. Remember, you can find us in multiple ways. We are in the Apple and Android app on your mobile device. We are on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And you can also find us and get updates on the latest episodes by going to our website, retinapodcast.com. And there's a subscribe, a little entry where you can enter your email and get updates on the latest episodes as they release. You know, we love getting feedback on this and other podcast ideas. This episode was brought about by listener feedback based on the article Drs. Patel and Sternberg wrote. So if you have ideas, you have something you want to discuss, please just reach out. And we're happy to try to fit it in if it fits into what we kind of view as the vision of the podcast and what the listeners want to hear. And so thanks again to Louis Kai, Angel Chang, Mike Vanacasa for preparing this episode and the company social media production. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here, and the patients you take care of each week. This is Jay Schrader signing off.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.